Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest for this episode is Judge Scott Schlegel from Louisiana's Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. Welcome to the podcast, Judge.
Thanks for having me, Todd and Jody. Good to be here.
We were just joking offline. This is worth a brief mention, that the name of your court is a little confusing to those of us from Texas who practice in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, also in your town. Also, other courts in our state are courts of appeals and not court of appeals. But I wanted to make sure we had that correct, the Circuit Court of Appeal. How long have you been in office on that court now, Judge?
Going on 3 years. So I was on the trial court for a little over a decade and elected here in 2023.
Right. I do want to kind of give our listeners a chance to get to know you. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of introducing yourself, giving a little bit of your background and give a brief synopsis of what got you to your current position.
Yeah. You know, I was actually a financial advisor during the late 90s when the market went south for about 10 years. So my wife looked at me and said, you should go to law school. So I actually went to law school at night while I was a financial advisor by day. And then once I graduated law school, became a downtown lawyer doing products liability defense, civil products liability defense. I always joke, made great money and wasn't for me. So I became a prosecutor, made no money and loved life and enjoyed my time prosecuting cases. You know, it's a great job. It's a tough job. You know, it's we see some pretty terrible things as a prosecutor. And so, you know, I did that for about 5 years and just lived and breathed the courtroom. And the inefficiencies literally drove me crazy. I couldn't understand it. So I quit my job, took out a major medical, cashed out a 401k. My son was in school. My wife was in school. And I ran for judge and thankfully won. And since day one, it has always been, what can I do to make the justice system more efficient, effective, and accessible? And, you know, in my estimation, that is using simple off-the-shelf technologies to do things a little bit better. You know, I always say, run your business better. We're not talking about human judgment. We're not talking about replacing judges. We're just talking about the business side of it and how I can make it a more efficient practice. So when I was on the trial court, the first thing I did was, you know, that big red book that every minute clerk has. And in order to get a hearing, you have to call the minute clerk and hope that they call you back. Or you have to send a runner to get a date. And it drove me crazy. So I took the big red book, tossed it in the trash, put my calendar online, allowed lawyers to pick their own dates, call opposing counsel, make sure it works for everybody. I sent you text and email reminders with a Zoom link before Zoom was a word. That cost $150 a year. And, you know, that's just one simple example to modernize the justice system and just make the process better.
So when you got on the bench, was it a general jurisdiction court? Was it criminal?
Yep. Handled criminal, civil, domestic. And then I also built a couple of specialty courts. So then I ran a reentry court and a swift and certain probation program. So I had, you know, at any given time, over 100 and some odd probationers and specialty courts that I was managing as well.
Wow, that's cool. So how early did you start Zoom? I mean, I know a lot of people picked it up for the pandemic.
2014.
Wow.
I mean, I was elected in 2013. So that online calendar started in 2014. And I was using off-the-shelf products. You know, before AI was a thing, my speech was, I can modernize the justice system for under $1,000 a year in any jurisdiction in under 30 days, and I'll do it for you.
Wow.
And I have no coding skills whatsoever.
Well, that's really, I mean, it sounds like you went in, I don't want to say really shook things up, but my curiosity is getting the better of me now. And I'm curious about how your peers on the trial bench responded to your blazing the trail technologically.
You know, look, judges are people just like lawyers are people. If you're in a firm and you go to the senior leadership, you know, some of them are in, some of them are not today, not tomorrow, never. And so, you know, you've got all of that. And so, you know, the beauty of, and one of the reasons I ran for judge to begin with is the beauty is if you are the judge and you are run your courtroom how you want to run your courtroom. I mean, people can't tell me no. And so I was able to modernize my own chambers, and then those who were interested, I would help them. Those who were not interested, you know, there are 99 problems, and that's not one of them, you know, and I just need your votes, you know? Hey, you don't need to do it, but I need your votes to get the budgets to do these things. And like I said, it doesn't cost that much money. So it really wasn't an issue. And I say how easy it is, but it's not easy. And we all know how difficult it is. Change management is very difficult. But, you know, you can tell me no today, but I'll outlast you.
How did that go? I know in Texas, when people jumped to Zoom, it was by necessity in the pandemic. And then as things started to open back up, there were some kind of conflicts between what the civil procedure rules allowed and what courts were doing. How did that work? Were you able to kind of navigate the rules and manage to set everything up pretty easily, or did you run into some conflicts there?
Yeah. So, I mean, prior to the pandemic, and, you know, we'll use that example. I used it for pretrial conferences. The, hey, how you doing? The, why are y'all driving 2 hours and paying for parking when you can just jump on a Zoom or just say, hey, how you doing? Where are we with discovery? Have you deposed X, Y, and Z? Have you issued, you know, propounded discovery requests? You know, where are we on that? I mean, I never understood why you would drive to court to do it. And I know why as a trial court judge, because that was your time to meet your opponent as opposed to just picking up the phone and doing it. You use chambers as a meeting site. And so the rules didn't really weren't an issue for pretrial conferences. For hearings, you know, we weren't having motion hearings since 2014. It was typically for pretrial conferences. And we already had remote witness testimony rules in the civil procedure. I'm sure Texas did as well. There were some nuances to it. So as the pandemic continued, we certainly went and modified the rules of civil procedure statutorily, worked with legislators and lawyers and got the rules for criminal and civil the way we thought that we needed them. So certainly there were some legislative changes that need to be made post-pandemic. But again, when you're dealing with a pandemic, you know, the Constitution trumps every local rule and every civil procedure that exists.
I mean, people certainly became more open-minded during the pandemic about how to get things done. And so at least now everybody knows what Zoom is. And so you're still a tech evangelist, but you don't seem like maybe you're so far out there anymore that the things that you rolled out to the trial court after you left, I want to get into your current position a little more, but after you left, have the changes that you made stuck in the district court?
For the most part, you know, there were other things, you know, for criminal, we integrated text and email reminders right into the case management system to cut down on failures to appear. And that still exists because it's got baked into the way we did things. Obviously, judges have their own opinions on whether or not hearings should be held via Zoom or not. We actually had a legislator passed a law that essentially says that you can opt in on the front end and the judge has to allow you to attend virtually unless there's good cause why not to. So they did the whole, you know, the reverse on it to kind of manage those issues. And look, you know, you said I'm a tech evangelist. That's true, but it's more of the justice system. And so I tried horrific murders and child rapes and all these terrible things. And the best thing to do is walk up to a jury and hand a photograph and not try and show it on the big screen up there. So tech for tech's sake is not what I do. Technology to advance justice is what I propose and what I'm a proponent of. And sometimes, like I said, no tech is the right answer.
Did you find improvements in things like non-appearances and people that were pro se being able to navigate? Did you see that impact pretty quickly?
Oh, absolutely. Again, once I did it for civil, it was the same $150. I flipped it to the criminal. I didn't give them the opportunity to pick dates, but I would say, you're hereby ordered to appear on this date. What time would you like to come? 9, 10, or 11? I got 100 on my criminal docket. I can't hear 100 cases at 9 a.m. So why am I making 100 people come to my courtroom and cause mayhem? You might have to take the bus. You might have to drop your kids off at school. You might have to bum a ride. Tell me what time you want to come. You're coming on this day, but tell me what time you come. And when they would make that selection, I would then have them sit down at the computer and put their name and everything in there. And then I would send them text and email reminders to cut down on failures to appear. And those emails would also include the phone numbers of all the public defenders that were assigned to our division. It would include all the different forms that they may or may not need. So it was an information. It was pointing to a website that I built using Squarespace for $300, you know, and I just had a page for everything. If you were in this probation, you had this page. If you had this, you had this page. All the information that you needed was there. You know, use it to reduce the barriers. Once you reduce the barriers, look, no more excuses. You know, you decide, I decide. And I've provided you the information.
Did you, I don't want to call it client feedback, but you get the idea where I can imagine that in terms of user satisfaction, so to speak, that those arrangements in your court when you're on the trial bench, you know, it had to make it just that much better for the participants. Did you get feedback like that from the folks that appeared before you?
I mean, colloquially, yes. I mean, I didn't send out a survey. How was your experience today? Well, you put me in jail, so yeah. I wasn't too good. or you ruled against my client. I hate Judge Schlegel. I don't know what that looks like, but certainly, you know, I think lawyers were appreciative of the ability to, you know, look at the calendar online and find a date that worked for everybody so that I have to file motions to continue because no one can consult with them about the date that was good for everybody. You know, I don't want to say I built an app, but I had an app that you could save to your home screen that was a web-based app. And it literally was click here to schedule a hearing, click here to drag and drop your courtesy copy, click here for sample jury charges, click here for phone numbers. And you know where those papers went when you sent me a courtesy copy? In the trash. So just drag and drop it on my website. And then I'll be sitting there on a Sunday watching a ball game and I'm getting ready for trial because it just hit my iPad.
Yeah, it just made me, I ask you about the customer satisfaction. It makes me think of another episode that we did, you know, gosh, probably 2 years ago now about procedural justice and the feeling that, you know, if people feel like they're heard and that the judge is listening and treating them fairly, that makes a big difference in how they feel about the result.
Oh, it absolutely does. You know, your time's just as important as my time and, you know, I'll never be late. If I'm late, call the cops, you know, something's happened to me. Because your time's just as important and, you know, you're not going to like every decision I make, but I want you to understand that I hear you, see you, I've read everything, I'm ready to go. And how can I reduce barriers? No reason to make people, you know, I always use the DMV example. You know, if you're sitting at the DMV for 3 hours, when you get to the front, you're just mad and you're not listening to what they're saying anymore. And we use that with probationers. If, you know, if the whole point of people in these drug courts and these specialty courts is to help them get healthy so that there are no more victims and hold them accountable, and you make them sit for 2 or 3 hours, and how are they going to listen to the counselors that are trying to help them through the issues that they're dealing with? They're not. So, you know, using all of these tools to build a better DMV enables people to listen. It doesn't remove who you are. Doesn't remove, I'm going to hold you accountable. It doesn't remove any of that. It's simply a way to help people succeed in life so that there are no more victims.
Well, you spent that decade on the trial bench and now you've moved on to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal and have been there for a few years. How has that transition gone in terms of your adjustment to the new environment and assessment of their tech for justice situation? And what have you been able to do or needed to do in that transition?
Yeah, look, it's a completely different job. You guys are appellate lawyers. It is a completely different job than the trial court. And thankfully, I came into a court that had already built its own case management system for the past 10 or 15 years. So everything was digitized. And it's a phenomenal foundation and a chief and a bench that are interested in looking for, you know, the next iteration. I want to move at the speed of light. And, you know, it takes a little time to get, you know, everybody to understand and appreciate these things. But that's good. I mean, that's the way it should be. It's not our job to be first. It's our job to get it right. And so, you know, I wrote this morning, I don't know if y'all saw it, build a frictionless system and then find out where friction needs to be placed back in. Because, you know, when I was starting out with these Gen AI tools, friction was a good thing. It was good for my inexperience. It prevented me from making errors. It prevented me from doing things. Now friction drives me crazy because I know how to use the tools. And I'm like, you know, give me my F1 race car that I can go. But, you know, I always joke I'm building, the private sector is building F1 cars for dirt tracks. And so, you know, how do we as a court look at these things? And it should be slower than I want. I'm not saying my way is the right way because I probably go too fast sometimes. So it's a good thing that I have colleagues that want to understand these things before we move forward. And now, almost 3 years in, we're looking at an on-prem AI servers where we can code it and train it and help out with central staff on civil cases. We'll be able to help out with intake at the clerk's office. You know, now I'm looking for the budget to do it and going forward.
How does it work in Louisiana for the appellate courts? Do you kind of have your court has its own budget and decisions on that kind of thing, management, or is it handled on a higher state level?
No, we're not centralized. Each court has their own budget. So legislature's in session right now. The judiciary has put forth its budget. You know, there's a line item for each circuit. We've asked for it. And, you know, hopefully we get what we've asked for. We never get all of what we've asked for. And then something pops up where the boiler goes out and the money that you needed for the AI server goes, Scott, it's good. I know you want your AI server, but we're not getting it now because we have a boiler what we have to fix. Because again, it is we are in a building that we have to manage and hire clerks and everything else. So.
Well, whenever we talk to a lawyer or a judge from another jurisdiction who is on the appellate side of things, I always like to ask, how many circuits in Louisiana for the courts of appeal?
That's five.
Five. Okay. We have a lot. We have 15. So I always like to compare notes because I'm fascinated by the states that only have one intermediate court of appeal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Five. That seems like a pretty good number. We have a lot, which is good for people like me and Jody.
Yeah.
So you've made the transition now fully over the past 3 years, which just happens to coincide with the real just blossoming, ballooning up of Gen AI being available. So now you can do even more than you could before in terms of coming up with some innovative strategies for dealing with cases and your caseload and management and all of that. And I have your colleagues, I know you're kind of taking the reins, it sounds like, on some of these projects, but your colleagues have been receptive, I assume, to the initiatives that you're bringing?
Oh, yeah. Again, it's a process. You know, it's a process that you start on day one. There are people that argue for more than I'm game for, and I push back and say no. So, again, there's always going to be that. So I can say, yes, my colleagues are supportive, but yes, my colleagues think I'm crazy at times, and that's okay, you know? But, you know, I think I do it in a measured approach. Again, you know, I always... as it relates to these tools, you know, if you've seen my website, you know, I drafted a guideline for judges, how to use Gen AI tools. And I always start with, you know, hopefully you're using enterprise level tools. Hopefully you're, you know, not using free ChatGPT or free Claude or free products. But, you know, if you're at least using the pro level $20 versions, here is a guideline to follow. It's not a tech guideline. It's here's how to be careful. Rule one of AI. Don't use AI. Do your job first. Get a direction. Get a feel. Understand the file. Don't just put it into a Gen AI bot and say, what's the answer? You know, and so it just walks you through 10 steps of how to use tools to go through the iterative drafting process if you decide to use it in a manner in which it's drafting. And hopefully, you're not drafting 30-page opinions using a Gen AI tool. That is not what I'm suggesting or referring to. But again, it's this whole friction thing. It's this, I want you to understand how these tools work. And here is what I have learned. And by the way, you already know how to do this. If you view the tool as a law clerk or a first-year associate or anything else, once you read the steps, you go, oh, I get what this is. You'd never rely upon, you know, a first-year associate for anything. Your central staff memos, you're going to read them and go, thank you, but you're still going to go do your job and you're going to walk through it. And so, you know, now that the tools are being baked into the tools that courts already trust, it's a different argument. So when I first started here, we didn't have the co-counsels and the protégés baked into these Westlaws and Lexuses that we could even afford. And so the previous iteration of what I tried to build was way too expensive. The tokens cost way too much. And there was just not a comfortable level of using tools that we aren't familiar with. And so I've always said, until the tools get baked into the tools that the courts trust, you won't see adoption for the chambers. Now that that's happening with your Office 365s and co-pilots being baked in on enterprise level, with the protégés and with the co-counsels, you're going to start seeing adoption going forward. And then you have other courts that are going, I get it. This is too much friction. It's driving me crazy. Give me the private sector's version of this tool. And so you're seeing that with the, you know, the clear briefs and the learned hands. And this is not me pushing any products. I'm just talking out loud. The enterprise level Claude, enterprise level ChatGPT, enterprise level Gemini. All of these things are the next, and I'm not saying it's next iteration, but it drops some of that and enables you to do more than necessarily some of the friction tools. And that's the way it should be. I always joke that, you know, you should have to level up before you touch the next tool. You know, like you got to like play the game and it tells you, all right, Judge Schlegel, you can now go to level two.
I think that's a great analogy. I'm going to borrow that when I'm trying to explain it to some people who are working on some of these things.
It really is. Well, so it seems like what you're seeing and taking part in leadership of on the advancement of use of these tools in the judiciary. You know, there's a lot of parallel between that and what's going on in the private sector with, or I could suppose it could be public sector lawyers too. And I'm sure, you know, judges face the same basic issues in terms of we've got hallucination problems still. You point out, don't use the free tools, use the paid ones for privacy reasons that get you that extra level or A level, preferably enterprise. That's even better. But I wanted to focus on this newer project that you've been a part of called the Judicial AI Consortium. I think you told me that can be shortened to JAIC, J-A-I-C. Why don't you tell us about it and kind of tell us your involvement in it, and just look forward to hearing more about it and how we can help you spread the word about it.
Yeah, so Judge Maritza Braswell, she's a magistrate judge out of Colorado. She came up with the idea, and she and I have spoken on panels together over this AI, you know, who are the judges who are using AI type thought process. So she called me and federal judge, she's a district judge, Xavier Rodriguez out of Texas. So she called the both of us and said, hey, look, what do you think of this idea, Jake? And the idea is very simple. Judges only, ask stupid questions, talk to each other about how you're using it, what you're seeing out there. Is it helpful? Is it useful? How far should we go? Is that too far? Is it not far? What rules are being in your state, in your courts? You know, everything from, do you have an AI policy? If not, why not? And the AI policy can be as simple as you can't use it. I hope that's not your policy, but your staff, people are using it. So our policy is very simple. You may use AI in these situations with these approved products, and you must tell your judge that you used it. That's it. You know, so we don't want to be those two federal judges that got hailed in front of Chuck Grassley about their hallucinations. And they said, my staff used Gen AI and we didn't know it. And there were some mistakes in there. So again, it's our job to get it, not to get be first. It's our job to get it right. And so when lawyers mess up, no big deal. You know, I mean, it is a big deal, but it's no big deal. We could sanction you. We could strike pleadings. You know, you can be embarrassed in front of your clients. You know, when we mess up, it's the law. It could become precedent. So it's a much different conversation. And so I encourage people to play around with it before they start using it in their own workflows. And that's the point of JAIC. The point of JAIC is, here are my experiences. There are other people like me out in the judiciary, and it's a great learning tool for all of us. Again, we're not recording anything. It's just a conversation for judges. So we have had a first meeting. We had over 100 judges from across the country, and then we are having what we're calling pop-ins, little 30, 45-minute, come if you can, conversations. The first one occurred last week. There was about 20, which is a perfect number for these pop-ins, and then we'll have a couple of more before our next big meeting in April. And so, you know, Judge Braswell led one, I'll lead one, Judge Rodriguez will lead another one. And again, it's just a great time for us to talk amongst colleagues and figure this thing out.
Surety bonds for court-related matters are a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Port Surety Bond Agency. CSBA has over 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA is able to provide first-class service with their deep understanding of the appellate process and the various timeframes involved in getting a bond in place.
I mean, I guess it's still early days for Jake, but do you envision it turning into a nationwide network of judges, or is it just going to?
Yeah, that's the hope.
Okay.
I mean, I think it already is. You know, I think, you know, we've already got over 200 people, over 200 judges who have signed up. We've had international judges who have wanted to sign up, and we're keeping it to the U.S. only for now. But yeah, I mean, I think 200 judges with a couple of emails is a pretty good starting.
Absolutely. Did you use AI to write your prompt to send out to them?
Absolutely.
There you go.
Would you not? That is a perfect use case.
Yeah, your point about the gravity of judicial AI use is well taken, because if a lawyer, if Jody or I do it and we mess up, you cite a hallucinated case and we get sanctioned, you know, that's embarrassing, but that's more or less the end of it for us. But we're talking about, you know, embedding it into institutions, the extremely important third branch. And so, you know, I hadn't really quite thought about it that way, but we're all kind of numb at this point to seeing news reports about sanctions of lawyers who continue, amazingly to me, to not vet their documents properly. Although, as you point out, I mean, there are things that can happen, and I've seen it happen, where, you know, the first year associate is using ChatGPT, you know, in the gray and not disclosing it to his partner or her partner. And that's a problem. But boy, you know, yeah, when they start showing up in judicial orders or opinions, which has happened, I mean, the instances of that, I've only heard of a few. Are we seeing that becoming actually more of a problem? I know you're trying to educate so that that doesn't happen. But do you know about how many instances we've seen of that happening?
I only know of three, not that it hasn't done more. You've got the two federal judge opinions that had to be recalled. And then you have the state court order. I think it was in Georgia, a lawyer prepared an order for a judge. That order contained hallucinated cases. The judge signed it without checking it, and it went up. And actually, their higher court just affirmed the lower court's signature on that order saying, y'all didn't bring this up. I'm sorry.
Oh, wait, what?
you know, you have to object. I don't think it affected the final outcome. It's probably the answer. I haven't looked at it too hard, but I thought it was interesting that the Georgia Court of Appeal, I don't know if it was the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, just came out with their ruling on that hallucinated order.
So just the mere fact that a hallucinated case was cited doesn't affect the validity of the order is the end result on that one.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me. But there still has to be some teeth in the fact that the lawyer presented a proposed form of order to the court with a hallucinated case in it. And I suppose that's handled, you know, obviously outside of, can be handled outside of the judicial process, certainly outside of the process of the merits.
It's a good reminder of the courts when you're presented an order, run it, site check it first.
Yeah.
Before signing.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, look, that's all that we did at the trial court after make a ruling and said, now prepare a judgment and have it to the court within 10 business days.
Yeah.
You know, now we're going to have to look a little closer.
Yeah. I mean, that's very common in our state court practice. Our state court judges are not preparing their own orders. And so this is a real risk. And I hope that this, if nothing else comes out of this conversation, trial court judges in our state and elsewhere would really benefit, I think, from tracking what y'all are doing with Jake, because I'm sure that the judges are hearing about this from other sources. But just the idea that they can plug into a resource like this and be informed or better informed about the risks and about things that are happening around the country, to me, just seems like it brings a lot of value. I think your ranks may explode and you may wind up with more people than you want. You're going to have to start like regional chapters or something.
Yeah, something. But look, AIforjudges.com. If any judges listening and you want to sign up, AIforjudges.com. There's a few articles on there and a link to join and then receive emails from us to attend meetings.
Oh, I think that's awesome.
I know you're talking about, in Jake, the chamber side and the judge facing side and how you handle your policies and the tools. Are you also talking about the attorney and kind of other side of that? I mean, do you have policies in your court or statewide about how attorneys can handle AI or what they have to do?
Yeah, that's going to the game plan. Again, we've had two meetings so far. The game plan is to, you know, find those issues as they pop up and discuss them. And AI related, of course, there's plenty of other organizations you can learn how to do other things. But, you know, anything AI related that's hitting the courts, whether that's how do we use it to assist with access to justice issues? How do I use it to speed the process along? How do I use it to draft? How do I use it for administrative orders? How do I use it for all these? And what tools are we using and why are we using them? And, you know, what are the settings and how do you do this? I mean, anything related to AI in the justice system from the judicial's perspective will be discussed.
Has Louisiana created rules on attorney use of AI? I know some courts in Texas have local rules, but there hasn't been anything at a system level.
Yeah, so I was the chair of the Supreme Court's AI task force, if you will. And so I wrote a letter, open letter to every judge across the country saying, please don't do these rules, these orders saying you cannot use Gen AI. I did this as soon as MATA came out. I was like, for the love of God, do not issue orders. You know, it was, you cannot use AI. And I was like, well, then they can't use their computers. You can't use Gen AI. Well, all right, you can use it, but you got to tell me about it. And I wrote an open letter to the entire country saying, for the love of God, please don't do that. We have enough rules out there to address these situations. And thankfully, the Louisiana Supreme Court agreed and took the approach and sent a letter to the members of the bar, reminding them of all their duties, all the various rules that apply, and say, look, today we think the rules that exist cover every issue that we're seeing. We could change that, which is great. That's the way it should be. You know, there might be come a time where we actually need to pass a rule because you're not stopping the hallucinations. For the love of God, just stop. Just stop. And if you're not going to stop, maybe now is the time to come in and say, well, we're going to mandate 1 hour of AICLE for every lawyer. Again, I'm not a rules for rules sake guy. Thought the hallucinations would stop by now, but now I'm on the bandwagon of we should start mandating 1 hour CLE, not jazz hands CLE, an actual CLE that says, here are the risks and benefits of using AI. Here are some of the tools. Here are some of the settings. Again, we're not trying to make everybody experts, but you know, hopefully you'll pause after hearing that mandatory 1 hour AI CLE. And the fact that things change every single hour, you're always going to have good material for another 1 hour CLE the following year.
Oh, no doubt about it. Well, I'm glad to hear you talk about standing orders and local rules. And I assume that's something that's been discussed within Jake, or will be shortly, because that I was so glad to hear what you said about that, because it drives me insane when we have too many rules that are very issue specific. And I just saw on LinkedIn this week, some judge, I can't remember who or where, it actually issued or required a certificate in pleading saying you did not use Gen AI or AI. And you point out, you know, you can't really say that. Do you use a spell checker? Do you use anything? Yeah, brief catch. I mean, good grief. If you're almost committing malpractice if you don't use brief catch or something like that. And so I really favor, and I've said this before, but our ethical obligations are what they are, and they tend to cover all the situations. I mean, they've been in place for how long? Model ABA rules in the states that have adopted their own variations of them. So I'm very happy to hear you talk about discouraging the adoption of specific local rules and or standing orders, which is even worse, I think, addressing those issues, because it doesn't change anything about the ethics of our job that we have Gen AI.
Once you sign the dotted line, I can hold you accountable. And I don't care if, you know, I always joke, how many of you all ever had a paralegal or a first-year associate and signed the dotted line after they handed you a copy? Did you disclose to the court that your paralegal prepared this or that the first-year associate? No, you did not. You signed the dotted line. That means you own it.
Well, and that seems like the cases that I keep reading about AI, it seems like it's a knowledge issue rather than a rules issue. It's they didn't understand. Oh, I thought when it spit out these cases that those were good cases because it had checked them. And it's just a misunderstanding that no, it's answering your question with words that it's put together, and they may or may not be accurate words.
One thing that the folks committing those errors need to know is you can actually use Gen AI to avoid those problems. There are specific apps that will check you and make sure, or you can use the tools that are already there to avoid that.
And it's a great first use case for a judge. Proofread this document for me. It's not, don't change anything. Just proofread this thing for me. Just make sure that, you know, are there any spelling errors? Are there any misstatements of the facts? Are there any, you know, misstatements of the law? Cite check it for me. I mean, these are simple things that you're not going to get yourself in trouble by cite checking something or by proofreading something. It's great. It'll catch things that the human eye cannot catch. Once you've read the same brief or the same opinion 20 times, you can't see it anymore. You go blind.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there for sure. Well, I think that's a great overview of what Jake is doing. And like I said, it's still early days. And so there's a lot yet to come. But you gave the URL for Jake. And we'll certainly encourage every judge we know to check it out at every level. It sounds like it's something that's going to be worth tracking. I hope you do get to the point where you have to create local chapters. That would be awesome because it means that people, judges are interested and they want to learn about it and they want to potentially use it to help. I know you talk about AI, and we've talked about it on this show too, about AI as an access to justice issue. And, you know, more efficient justice on the judiciary side plays into that, dovetails into that. So I think it's very commendable what's happening. And we're certainly, I'm not familiar with Judge Braswell, but Judge Rodriguez is just down the road from me in San Antonio. I'm in Austin. And certainly very familiar with him. And he has written and spoken a lot here locally in our state on these same topics. And so it's great to know that we've got leaders in the judiciary, you know, standing out front and really encouraging other judges to speak up and pay attention to this. Is it fair to say, I mean, well, maybe you don't know kind of what the age distribution is among Jake folks yet, but you've got the digital natives who are comfortable with this. And now we're all old enough where we see digital natives, not necessarily us growing up, but digital natives are entering this phase of their career where they might be judges. You probably can't make any generalization about the distribution of age among the folks that have expressed interest in Jake so far, but I assume that the ones who are older, you know, are just generally trying to educate themselves about AI and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it is to some extent because, you know, look, I think I'm older than Judge Braswell and Judge Rodriguez is, you know, older than I am. And I don't think it's necessarily because you're a certain age, you can do this better than the other. Again, Judge Rodriguez, if you're listening, I'm not calling you old, but Judge Rodriguez, you know, knows how to do this just as well as I do. And he's at the end of his judicial career. You know, I think he's been on the bench almost 30 years now. So it's not like I'm the old person in the room and I can't do this. And if you frame it properly, then you can tell people you already know how to do this. You know, and frankly, younger people using these tools scare me more than older people using these tools, because the younger lawyers and judges may not have the scarring necessary to understand the nuance of the law. And it's this, you know, I use this example and we talked about war stories, so I'll give you one right now. When I first became a prosecutor, I was asked to third chair, not first chair, not second chair, third chair, a horrific homicide, multiple victims, DNA everywhere, mixed DNA samples, fire covering everything up. It was awful. I had no idea how to try that case, and I had no appreciation of, you know, how to present the evidence. But you know what I knew? I knew PowerPoint. This was right after the foam board, and I was like, look, that foam board stuff is nonsense. Let's do PowerPoint. So I convinced the senior prosecutor to allow me to. I used the diagram of the scene. I had all the evidence laid out. I had all of the different mixtures of DNA color-coded on every single piece of evidence. And he would say something, and I would push a button, and you'd get the next DNA sample. It was horrible. It was the worst presentation of evidence ever, because the senior prosecutor knew the timing, but he didn't know the tech. I knew the tech, but had no idea of the timing, and it fell very flat. It confused the prosecutor. It confused everybody. And that was not a good thing, because I didn't understand enough about trying the case. I didn't understand the nuances of a multiple homicide. I didn't understand any of that. So it didn't work well. But on the flip side, there was another homicide. This was before cell tower records were really a thing. But I was the young buck, so they threw the records to me and said, figure this out. And I remember the Saturday where I figured it out and I could pinpoint the defendant was here at the time of the murder, right on the murder scene. And I was able to track his flight to another state using cell tower records. So that was an example of when the youth, if you will, was helpful. And so I think it's this back and forth that we need to think through. And the senior lawyers need to be intentional about not just turning over to the juniors. And the juniors need to be intentional about learning the law before they just start using PowerPoint or Gen AI in this case, because you're just going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, I think about, you know, some people I know and who are older than me who have really made the effort to learn this stuff. And it's really all, it seems to me, just about mindset and understanding the big picture of how it, you don't have to know exactly how it works, but you just have to know how to use the tool, what the limits of the tool are. You know, we hear all the time the idea that, well, you've got to have the human in the loop. And I think you talk about that some. And I think you even maybe drill down a little further on that and say, you know, the right human in the loop, not just any human in the loop. What's your philosophy on that, Judge?
I mean, you hit it. I hate the terminology human in the loop. It's the right human in the loop. How old were you, Todd and Jody, when you got your driver's license?
I got a hardship license at 15.
So let's use that as example. My son's 20 now. So when he was 16, he got a car. Assume that I can retire at some point, and the dream car is the Turbo S911, right? And so let's assume my 16-year-old came up to me when I had the 911 Turbo S and said, "Hey, Dad, I got a hot date tonight. Can I take the Porsche?" And I'm like, "Sure, buddy, here you go." And I toss him the keys. What's going to happen? He's going to put that car into a tree or a wall. He's going to hurt himself, and he's going to hurt the little girl that he's took on a date. My point is, just because you have a law license doesn't mean you should get the 911 or the Gen AI tool. You don't know how to drive yet, even though you're a licensed lawyer, even though you're a sitting judge. You don't have the skills necessary to handle that much power. And that goes to my friction conversation. And so, you know, just because you're a labor lawyer doesn't mean you're going to become the best Med Mal lawyer that ever lived because you have a Gen AI tool. No, you're still going to hurt yourself even more so because you're going to be so confident that I'm a great lawyer that you think you know that skill set as a Med Mal lawyer. And it's the same thing with the court and everybody else. Just take it slowly. Do something you know really well. Learn the strengths and weaknesses of the tools so that you can go from the Buick to the Cadillac, maybe to the Honda, and then, you know, to the Porsche and the Lambos and everything else. So start small, start slow, do something today in a very controlled way so that you can learn the strengths and weaknesses. And once you learn how to use ChatGPT and you go over to Claude, they're completely different. And Gemini is completely different. They act differently.
Appellate courts have demanding procedural requirements. That's why you need an expert who understands the complexities of every court nationwide. Since 1938, Counsel Press has been the trusted partner of the AmLaw 100, providing unmatched expertise in appellate services from e-brief preparation to electronic filing. Their team manages document review and compliance, ensuring your appeals in expert hands from start to finish. Counsel Press, your trusted partner in every appeal. Visit counselpress.com today. Well, and this kind of dovetails, I think, too, with something you've talked about drift. You know, the tendency historically in judicial chambers is you've got the judge and staff. It can be administrative staff, lawyer staff. And the judge, depending on the court, is going to vary a lot by judge. Their reliance, their level of reliance on staff for original thought and drafting varies a lot. But if you've got a judge that relies on their, say, their law clerks a lot, that looks or sounds like to me a situation where that drift might come into play. There might be some risk. And I think by drift, what you mean is the tendency toward over-delegation. And maybe in this is perhaps the friction area for how AI in chambers is going to really work. I guess what I'm coming to on this is it seems like, yes, judges can dip their toe in this and try to understand it. But there's probably going to have to be some level of training, whether it be just in chambers, chambers by chambers, or say in your court wide, if there's a big rollout of using AI tools. If you've got an AI server in your courthouse, what is the plan or what would be the ideal plan, I guess is the way I would ask it, for how you ensure continuity in AI use and that there's not folks who are getting behind the Porsche, the wheel of the Porsche and driving it into a tree?
Take an iterative approach, go slow. Again, build your dream world and then back off and put friction back where friction belongs. You know, so dream big, build it, don't implement it. And then once you've built the dream world, go, all right, that we can't allow that drift to occur. Put that friction point back in right there. We're not allowing this thing to draft an opinion. You know, we're not allowing people to not struggle with the white page problem. I'd never, ever want people to hand this over and say, hey, give me a first. I'm not a first draft guy. I don't agree with it. I know some do agree with it. I don't agree with it. I don't ever want, you know, we hear this word bias all the time. I'm not talking about that kind of bias. I'm talking about confirmation bias. So that if something is already on a piece of paper, it's going to be the tail wagging the dog. And you're going to go in that direction and start down the line where no. You do the first draft, you struggle with the ideas, you struggle with the concepts, fight through it, get something, and then look, Use it to clean things up. Use it to say something better. Use it to finish a thought. But don't ever allow tail to wag the dog. And so I am a big opponent to first drafts. I don't like them. And I'm not talking about administrative orders. I mean, look, if you do something rote all day, every day, and you're just replacing names, sure, use it to draft administrative orders. And even on, you know, again, like a writ that is a motion for summary judgment denied on the showing made, you know, something very simple, one or two, that's not white page problem that I'm talking about. I'm talking about handing over the pleadings and saying, what do you think, Grok? No, let's not do that. That's not the social contract. It's not anything that we signed up for. I would hate anybody to ever hear that they lost their kids because Grok said so. If they would have used Claude or ChatGPT, they would have had their kids. That's not the social contract. If you want to do that, go mediate it, go arbitrate it. That's fine. But that's not the justice system, and it's not something that I'm for.
So let's talk, just flesh out a little bit for us the idea of the social contract. What do you mean by that?
I mean, you and I signed up for a human to judge an issue. Period, the end. If you want the bots to do it because it's going to be faster, you know, all these buzzwords, consistency, transparency, all these buzzwords that we can have an entire hour debate on those terms. Whose singularity are you building for? I'll just leave it at that. That's not the social contract. I mean, we signed up for, we have a dispute, we bring it to the courts, we ask the courts to decide it. We then can say Judge Schlegel is horrible or not. Part of the feel we talked about earlier, Todd, part of the feel is to say, I hate that guy. He is a terrible judge and I'm taking him up and you can take me up. Can you imagine somebody losing their kids and saying, I hate ChatGPT? There's no feeling there. That is an algorithmic decision that was made and that could change tomorrow because it was asked a different way or the algorithm changed. That is not the social contract. And again, I'm not saying don't go use these tools to mediate and arbitrate. That's a decision that was made by parties consensually. There's no consensual decision when you're in the justice system. I got sued or I have a problem and I'm bringing you into court to handle this issue. And I think that your voice matters, Todd. Your voice matters, Jody. And my voice matters. Voice matters. And it needs to be handled by a human.
Got it. That's like the ultimate case of drift. If you're just handing over everything to the bot, to the robot overlords, I understand. I get it. And it takes me back to something I read about a lot. And I think this is always a good way of looking at what AI is and can be is thought partner. And you describe it perfectly, Judge. You know, start with your blank first draft, as we hear it described, starts with an S. And let, you know, get input on it. And, you know, is it logically consistent? You know, are there, what errors are in it? You know, things like that are great uses of the tool. The idea of your discussion of that overall concept made me think about something I read about not too long ago, too, that I think it was the AAA, American Arbitration Association, now has this chatbot-generated arbitration process, but the parties are consenting to it. So there's not a social contract problem, right? And there are very close parameters, tight parameters built around it, as I understand it. And that's not what we have in terms of the general use of general AI or Gen AI in to generate, go from zero, you know, blank page to opinion with no input from the judge. Just what do you think? I'm still curious how that AAA thing's going to work out, but you know, that we shall see. But that's not the way the judicial process ought to work out. So appreciate your comments on that. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time together today, but I do want to ask you, in terms of the practitioners that come before you as a judge, do you have some concrete things that lawyers, you're, let's say, coming into your court, tips that you might give to them in terms of the use of Gen AI? It sounds like, as I said earlier, there's a lot of parallel between the way that judges use it and the way that, or should use it, and the way that lawyers should. Is there anything specific to the lawyer use case that comes to mind that you want to bring to folks' attention?
Lawyers should be using this to write better arguments to the court. I don't know why you wouldn't use it. Again, this always premises you understand how to use it. But if Todd is a great appellate lawyer, Todd will write a better brief after he's written his brief personally or in tandem with that will make it clearer for the courts to understand what he is trying to say. Again, you're not turning it over. The bot can make a suggestion. You're like, that's terrible. Yeah. I'm not telling the judge that. If you use it critically, then you're going to write a better brief to the court. And this is an appellate podcast. So, you know, you might be a great orator, Todd, but I've pretty much read everything. I'm pretty good. When you, by the time you get there, you know, there are some issues that are very, very confusing that you're, you know, it's important for oral argument. And I want to hear about it and everything else. But I mean, for the most part, you're writing your opposition, your reply, that's already forming the ideas before we even get in there. And so I would absolutely use it to tear your opponent's brief apart. Use it to prepare for oral arguments. Use it to prepare your own briefs. I would use, you know, they have Google Notebook LM, which is a sleeper that nobody talks about. I mean, you can feed briefs into it and literally create podcasts for yourself to listen to arguments to get ready for your own oral arguments. Again, go for a jog. Use it to walk. Delete it and do it again and see what they are actually talking about. It's just a great way to get you thinking through arguments. Ask these tools to be a panel. And at what questions are you in? Feed at the pleadings. Hey, you're my panel. I'm about to go for oral arguments. Ask me a bunch of questions and just go back and forth with it. Just get hit by the panel of AI bots so that you can get ready for oral arguments. I mean, these are great ways to use these tools. As an advocate, I would use it all day, every day, because you want to go a certain lane. You want it to confirm everything that you're saying. That is a great use case. And my job is to get it right. Your job is to convince me that you're right. So use these bots to sharpen your tools.
I think that's great. It's our tradition to always wrap up with a tip or a war story. And you've given us some great tips, but I don't know if you've got more or if you have a war story you want to share as we close.
I won't give you another war story, but I'll leave it at this. It's going to be okay. We've been here before. We're going to get through it again. Y'all remember about 20, 25 years ago when you were in that first CLE and that lawyer walks up to you and says, hey, Todd, Jody, come over. I want to show you something. I got my client files in the cloud. And you're like, the cloud? What are you talking about, the cloud? You're like, yeah. All my client files are up there in the air. And if I wanted, I just pull it up and we're like, you're going to jail. You're going to lose your law license. What are you talking about, the cloud? But what did we learn from that? We learned a couple of things. Today, if you're not using a cloud-based storage, you're probably the one committing malpractice. Today, we learned that you don't use free, because free is bad. We learned if you're going to use cloud-based, you need to make sure that you have the right license for the right types of files. We understood if it's a medical record, it needs to be a HIPAA-compliant cloud-based storage. And all of the same lessons are here today for Gen AI. Don't use free. Make sure the settings are right. Don't let it to be trained off of you. All of these different things we understand. So we've been here before. We'll get through it. It's all good. That's what lawyers do. We adapt. We go, you know, we keep moving forward and we figure things out. So you'll be good. If you need a hug, ask Todd or Jody. I'm sure they'll give you one.
We'll put up a booth at the next appellate conference, Jody. Free AI stress hugs.
Yeah, good luck with that. Trying to get appellate lawyers to hug each other. We'd make sure that there's about a 30-foot barrier around us if we tried that.
I love it. That's great. Well, Judge, this has been great. Sure appreciate your time. I personally know of places I can find you online. Do you want to just recite for our listeners the best places folks can find you to track what you're doing?
JudgeLegal.com, all there.
And I'll also commend, for those of you who are on Substack, I'll also recommend your Substack. Cover a lot of great topics there and things that really make me think. So I appreciate everything you do there. And thanks for being willing to come on with us. I know that when some strange appellate lawyer from Texas reaches out and says, hey, Judge, would you like to come on our podcast? I'm sure you're like, well, who are these guys? But you've been great. We certainly appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at @texapplawpod. Produced and powered by Law Pods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.